With virtually limitless design options, Pella is like your personal barista for windows and doors. Customize your order by August 31st and you can bundle and save big at Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin. Get started today at PellaWI.com.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the Old National Bank Talk and Text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank. Get old. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. Hope you had a wonderful weekend. The weather certainly cooperated. All sorts of activities going on, and now we are back to another work week. I want to start off today's program, unfortunately, on sort of a downer note, because the string of violence in this community continues, and I hope we don't lose the ability to be shocked by things, because there was another shocking death over the weekend. A one-year-old child was shot on the city's north side Saturday night. This happened in the area of around 27th and Capitol. If you can picture this, it is the 10th homicide of a minor in the city this year. Little girl who was about a week away from her second birthday was shot in a vehicle by a 27-year-old man who was arrested yesterday afternoon in a traffic stop on the freeway in Kenosha. He's been arrested. They anticipate there's going to be charges. Maybe we're going to have his name by the end of the program. I don't know. But they believe that there was a 27-year-old guy who was the shooter in this case. The description is that this incident happened during an argument between adults around 8:11 p.m. in the 1900 block of West Atkinson Avenue near the Milwaukee Public Library. The child was transported to Children's Hospital, where she died from her injuries. The story in the Journal Sentinel has the mayor saying, "I've been talking consistently about the need for people to be better with guns, to have better control on guns, to put guns down, because nothing good ever happens when you pull the trigger," which I think we would all, you know, say amen to that. But there's an interesting aspect of the Journal Sentinel story about this that I wanted to read to you. Now, we don't know all the details about what happened, but essentially you have two adults who get into an argument, I presume, and one pulls out a gun and starts shooting. And as a result, that this almost two-year-old girl is shot. This, again, it's affecting young people quite a bit. So far, 27 child victims were reported in 2022. But it's very, very bad. Okay. So we're trying to figure out why it is that this is going on. And here's what the Journal Sentinel writes. Criminologists and local officials have pointed towards a range of possible causes, a range of why it is that young people are being shot, including increased gun carrying, easy access to firearms, and lingering aspects of the pandemic, which may have had a larger impact on children. Increased gun carrying, easy access to firearms, and lingering effects of the pandemic, which may have had a larger impact on children, which is used as an explanation for why a 27-year-old is involved in pulling out a gun and shooting, and a small child happens to be, you know, one of the victims of this. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Now, look, I don't disagree that, you know, I guess if more people are carrying guns, there is a greater likelihood that somebody might use it illegally. If people have easy access to firearms, meaning they get more guns, I understand that. Lingering effects of the pandemic, well, that's a tougher one. But it seems to me that you can look at all that stuff. But if we are trying to explain why it is that the homicide rate is soaring and that the homicide rate among younger people is soaring, there's a much easier explanation than, well, you know, easy access to firearms and the pandemic. 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. At its heart, why do you think, what is the primary reason why it is that we have the level of gun violence that we have in this region, in this community, and I think you can say in this country? At the end of the day, is it increased gun carrying? Is that the principal reason? Is it easier access to firearms? Is it lingering aspects of the pandemic? Or is it something actually much simpler and much more straightforward. 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line, and that's where we start the program. What is it that is leading to these skyrocketing numbers of people being shot? We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620, which is the Old National Bank talk and text line. This conversation, I guess to me, misses what the major point is. Like the story in the paper trying to, again, say, okay, why are we having this wave of kids being shot, including this horrible story from over the weekend where a one-year-old is shot as a gun battle breaks out at about 8 o'clock on a Saturday night. And the criminologists and local officials look to lots of causes. Increased gun carrying? Well, okay. I mean, right, if more bad guys have guns, all right, they're more likely to use them. Easy access to firearms, all right. Lingering effects of the pandemic, I kind of have that with the question mark. But I think that that's missing the point as to why it is that we're having these unacceptable levels of violence. Let's start with Rob in Port Washington. Rob, you're on WTMJ.
Hi.
Hi, Rob. What do you think?
Well, I'm thinking it comes down to parents. I mean, it comes down to where these kids are out at all times. Everything is accessible. They don't teach them right from wrong. I mean, I can go out and buy a gun, but I don't because I know it's wrong. But you have kids out at 2 in the morning, and where are the parents when all this stuff is happening? I mean, it's just comes down to where it's got to be taught right from wrong. And
well, no, thanks. I think that's an element. Wagner's rule of life, kind of like jokingly, number four is that nothing good happens outside a strip club at 2:30 in the morning, which is true. But it's also true, and you're exactly right, that when it comes to young people, when it comes to kids, nothing good happens out after curfew. I mean, nothing great's going to happen at 11 o'clock at night when you have young people are on the streets. At the same time, this particular situation, this is a 27-year-old guy. That is who they have arrested. They haven't released the name yet. So this is a 27-year-old. This isn't a youth crime. This is a 27-year-old that pulls out a gun and starts shooting and hits an almost 2-year-old girl. I don't think they were aiming at the 2-year-old girl. They were probably aiming at other people, but they hit the 2-year-old and she ends up dead at 8 o'clock at night on a Saturday. Let's talk to Mary in Little Chute. Mary, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Hey, I think it's because when kids are younger and they commit crimes, there's no consequences for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they steal a car, they beat people up, they rob, whatever it is they do. And then it just continues to escalate because if they got away with whatever they got away with, then it just keeps continuing until it escalates and then they shoot and kill someone.
You know, it's going to be interesting, Mary. Like I say, the guy that has been arrested in connection with this shooting, so far they haven't released his name, and we don't know anything about him other than the fact that it's a 27-year-old male that was picked up yesterday afternoon. What do you want to bet, Mary, that when we find out the name and the guy's background, it turns out that this isn't his first time at the rodeo and that there is some sort of criminal record behind him? Now, I don't know that for sure, but what do you want to guess? What do you think the odds are that this is a guy who's been through the criminal justice system before the shooting last night?
Oh, I bet you 100% there, Jeff.
Yeah, I'm not going to take that bet. No, thanks for calling. I guess that's what jumped out at me about this story. Criminologists, local officials point towards a range of possible causes. Increased gun carrying. Well, yeah. If people that are inclined to misuse guns are more likely to have them. Yeah, I mean, I buy that. I understand that. Easier access to firearms. Right. Especially with people who shouldn't have firearms getting them. Right. That's a fact. Lingering aspects of the pandemic. I think that's kind of a stretch. But yeah, increased gun carrying and easier access to firearms. But it comes down to people who, as a general rule, should not have guns in the first place, whether it is because they have the guns because they want to commit crimes with them, or alternatively, they have committed crimes. They are not legally allowed to possess guns, and yet they have them nonetheless. And that's the question that I think you always have to ask. It is one of the reasons why I am so frustrated with this idea that we don't have mandatory minimum penalties, for example, for felons with guns. The shooting yesterday, I don't know if the guy, Saturday night, I don't know if the guy is a felon or not. I don't know if he's legally allowed to possess guns or not. My guess is, it's just a guess, my guess is he probably was not legally allowed to have a firearm, because I don't think you wake up one day and just out of the clear blue say, hey, I've got this gun, I'm going to pull it out, I'm going to shoot at somebody and end up killing an almost 2-year-old girl. My guess is that we're going to find out that he has a criminal record and probably wasn't legally allowed to possess guns in the first place. But I don't know that for sure. Maybe I'm going to be wrong about that. And if that's the case, I'll say so. But so often when we have these crimes that are committed by people with guns, it's people who aren't legally allowed to carry guns in the first place. So if you're asking me, Jeff, do I think we should tighten access to firearms, especially among people who aren't legally allowed to carry guns in the first place? I say amen. Absolutely. No question about it. It's one of the reasons it's always so frustrating to me that you see crime after crime after crime after crime that is committed by people who have felony records and aren't allowed to carry guns, which is one of the reasons why the legislature needs to wake the heck up and say, look, we've got to treat this seriously. And if you are a felon and you are in possession of a firearm, boom. You know, we're not going to dismiss that charge. We're going to impose mandatory minimum penalties. We are going to send a message out there that unless you like being in prison, you know, once you're convicted of a felony and you're told you can't have guns, if you have guns, you're going to be going back to prison. 855-616-1620. Lori in Burlington. Hi, Lori. You're on WTMJ.
Hi, Jeff.
What do you think?
I feel that so many of these people think they deserve respect and entitlement, and that's what they use to get it amongst their peers. I don't believe that they are thinking of their consequences at all. It's a respect thing, and they think they're entitled to do whatever they can do when they want to do it.
Yeah.
Without any kind of payback or any kind of consequences.
Right. And no,
it's,
right.
It's
right.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. I always describe it as like the impulse control of a fruit fly. You know, back in the day, it would be, okay, if you get into an argument because somebody said something nasty about your girlfriend or whatever, two guys might go out and they might throw a couple punches or something, and one guy loses and one guy wins and one guy ends up in the emergency room. You're right. Nowadays, everybody is carrying guns, and people, you disrespected me. Here, I'm going to pull out my gun and I'm going to shoot at you, and in this case and then I'm going to hit the 12-year-old, or I'm going to hit the 2-year-old that's sitting in the car or whatever. I think, you know, there is something to about that. Just no control, no thought of consequences at all.
Right. It's an easy way out.
Yeah, right. Thanks for calling. And I mean, it's just, but again, I think that dovetails back to the point that our first caller was making about, you know, the lack of upbringing and the understanding of right versus wrong. I mean, because I don't think it should be too much of a stretch to say that, all right, pulling out a gun and shooting it at someone because you're honked off at them or you feel disrespected or whatever. And then, of course, you end up, and that's what happens, you know, you end up shooting, in this case, it's a 2-year-old or an almost 2-year-old who just happens to, I guess, in the line of fire or gets hit by a stray bullet or whatever that is. Those details are going to emerge. But it is this lack of appreciation, no impulse control, like you say, Lori, and also this lack of appreciation of consequences and a lack of fundamental understanding about right and wrong, that you have people who are just willing to do this. Now, I think that actually explains why you have, I don't know, stories like the 14-year-old that's armed to the teeth or has got the gun coming down the escalator at Mayfair Mall a couple years ago, who pulls out the gun and just starts shooting at people because, you know, they feel disrespected or it's a rival gang or whatever. You know, but it also, it doesn't, I think, explain that the 27-year-old. Now, I think, you know, it will be interesting once his name comes out. You know, was this somebody who should have been on the streets? Was this somebody who had a prior criminal record? I mean, those are all the things that you want to know. But what's so, I guess, troubling and scary about all of this is, you know, this case is getting attention and will continue to get a lot of attention because there's, again, a small child who ended up being murdered. But shootings like this happen, unfortunately, all the time. And whether, you know, maybe it'll be a little blip on the TV news or maybe it'll be a blip in the newspaper, although a lot of the shootings, just there's so many of them, don't even make the newspaper unless there's some sort of serious injury or a death or something like that. But it is, I think, reflective of what's going on. And I think we need to grapple with the issue. Yes, are people carrying guns? Absolutely. Is there easy, maybe you want to argue, you know, uncomfortably easy access to firearms? I'm not going to argue that point, but it's especially the easy access to firearms for the people who shouldn't have firearms in the first place. Look, the vast majority of people who are gun owners, it would never occur to them to pull out a gun and start shooting, you know, when there's a child in the background. That's just the reality of it. And what we need to come to grips with is that there is a certain criminal element that's out there that is willing to use these guns. And those are the people that I think is a starting point. You got to start targeting. And when you say, well, targeting, what do you mean? I said, well, it starts with, you know, what one of our other callers was saying, when people are starting to commit crimes, we don't do them a favor by slapping them on the wrist and not holding them accountable. And then when they have committed crimes and they, you know, get out or they're released on probation or parole or whatever that is, or they have a prior record and we tell them, okay, you're a felon, you're not allowed to have a gun, and they get caught carrying a gun, we're not doing anybody a favor by not coming down hard on them. More details about this is going to be emerging, but it's much more, in some respects, it's more complicated. In other cases, it's more simple than, well, you know, why do we have all these causes of shooting? Easy access to firearms, increased gun carrying, lingering effects of the pandemic. At its heart, though, it comes down to criminally inclined people who are willing to commit crimes. And to the extent they have committed crimes, why don't we hold them accountable?
Crafted.
Of course we would. We just eat more. And buy really expensive ketchups with it. That's right. All the fancy.
Well, there you go. 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text. What is $9 million between friends? All right. You may remember this story. Back in, 2022, May of last year, there was this much ballyhooed proposal that was rolled out to create what they refer to as the Iron District. And this was about an 11 acre area that's, just a little bit to the north and slightly to the west of where I'm sitting now. It's a development that, north 6th Street and south of West Michigan downtown, kind of up in the area by Marquette, kind of. And the plan was, what we're going to do is we're going to, on this space, we're going to build an 8,000-seat soccer stadium for a minor league professional soccer team. And then we're going to have a 3,500-seat venue, an entertainment facility. And then what we're going to do is we're going to have some subsidized housing, and then we're going to have a hotel. Remember, that was the plan. Well, all right, since then, The plan for the entertainment venue has pretty much fallen through. It's largely been changed. The housing program is going on because they were able to get public money to help underwrite it. And so the cornerstone always was going to be that this 8,000-seat soccer stadium. The estimates at the time were that the soccer stadium was going to cost $40 to $45 million. Now, that might be correct, but one of the things that we've seen is that you have these initial estimates, and then stuff costs a lot more. In a couple other similarly sized cities where they built soccer stadiums, that $40 million or so was the original estimate, and then it turned into $50 or $60 or $65 million. But $40 to $45 million was the idea. That's how much it would be. Governor Evers said, all right, here's the deal. I am willing to take $9.3 million in taxpayer money, and I'm willing to essentially put that towards the development of this soccer stadium. So the taxpayers of the state would be picking up I don't know, 20% or so of the cost. So that was the idea. He put $9.3 million in the budget. And I think it's been reported in multiple places that getting public money, whether it's the money from the state or money from the city or money from the county, was a key to making this deal work. Well, is part of the ongoing, you know, budget stuff going through the legislature in the last couple of days, the state Joint Finance Committee, which is controlled by Republicans, took that $9.3 million out. So as it stands now, there's no state money that is available for the construction of this soccer stadium. Now, I don't know where a county or the city might be, other than to say, given everything that's going on, the huge, you know, structural deficits that Milwaukee County has and the city of Milwaukee has, given all the fights that are going on right now about the whole concept of shared revenue and how can we get more money back from the state. And if we don't get more money back from the state, we're going to have to, you know, essentially go the equivalent of bankruptcy, even though a municipality can't technically declare bankruptcy. But, you know, they're not going to have money to meet their obligations. And even if they get increased shared revenue, and even if we have the ability to increase the sales taxes in the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, that's still not going to generate enough money to meet all the needs that are out there. So given all that, it seems to me that expecting either the city or the county to contribute anything significantly towards building a soccer stadium on that piece of property is probably slim to none, and slim is on a bus out of town. I don't know that for sure, but given all the other priorities that are out there, given the fact that you have the county board already on record saying that they don't want to contribute a dime towards stadium improvements at American Family Field, a facility that I think unquestionably generates a lot of revenue, expecting either the city or the county to come up and put a bunch of money into a building or underwriting a building for a minor league soccer stadium, I think my guess is that's a bridge too far. And so I think the best hope was money from the state. And at least at this point, it appears that that is dead in the water as well. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Now, as we hear repeatedly, we have a budget surplus. You know, we have a governor who wants to spend a lot of that budget surplus on various projects. I mean, one of the projects that was out there is the governor wanted to kick in a couple $100 million out of that to help, you know, fund the improvements that are going to be necessary to American Family Field. So given the money that's out there, $9 million is, I guess, a relatively small amount of money. I'm putting that in air quotations when we say relatively small, but, you know, there's a lot of money around there. My question is, all right, is the legislature making a mistake by not underwriting the cost, or at least helping underwrite the cost of a soccer stadium for a minor league soccer team? And presumably clubs would be able to use it. Marquette would be able to use it. It's the cornerstone of this Iron District project, which has had trouble getting traction. I think that would be fair to say, other than the subsidized housing, which is going ahead because they got money from the government. 855-616-1620. $9 million to help build a soccer stadium. Would this be money well spent? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. Now, let us be fair. When the Bradley Center was torn down and Fiserv Forum was built, that was a public-private partnership. The sports team, the Bucks, put in money. The state put in money, et cetera. And I think you have to understand that's been a success. You know, you've had the Deer District, which has been created around that. And so I think that has helped the development of that area around the Park East. I mean, for 15 years, the Park East, you know, that space where it was under the shadow of that freeway that used to exist, I mean, that was a moonscape. despite we were promised, oh, this is going to lead to all this development. And that never happened until you had Fiserv Forum built. So there was development. So you can argue that, okay, is this community better because we took taxpayer dollars and we contributed to building a place for, you know, sold out concerts and NBA basketball and all the other stuff? And the answer is, I mean, yeah, I don't think the jury's out on that. I think it was a good investment. So here's the question now. Should we be making a similar investment up in the Iron District, the area where like the old Ramada Inn used to be, which is, I mean, pretty much of a moonscape, too, to be honest with you. And the argument is, if you build an 8,000-seat soccer stadium, use that as the keystone for this other stuff. Now, they're already talking, like I say, about an entertainment venue. That's already been changed materially. They were talking about a hotel. That's very up in the air. The only thing of this original proposal, which appears to be moving ahead with any speed at this point in time, is subsidized housing, in part because there's federal and state money to help underwrite that. So now a legislature said, sorry, Governor, we're not kicking in $9 million to help build this soccer stadium. Is that being short-sighted? 855-616-1620. Jeff, let's see. The Wave is lucky if they get 1,000 fans for a game. How is anybody going to get 8,000? Well, the Wave, of course, is the indoor soccer team. And I think the argument would be, well, soccer's bigger and getting bigger all the time. And if you had a minor league soccer team, it would attract people in a way that indoor soccer does not. 855-616-1620. I don't know about that. Jeff, I think it's time that we stop subsidizing all of these different organizations that are often backed by very wealthy people. First of all, the surplus money in the state is our money and belongs to the people throughout the whole state. All of us may not have the same interests. Secondly, all we hear about are all the social issues that there's no money for, but we always seem to have money to subsidize millionaires and billionaires. See, to me, that sort of hits it at what the fundamental question is. I don't think I'm being inconsistent when I say this. I have been a proponent. I supported, you know, taxpayer money to build Miller Park because I thought it was going to be, I know they call it American Family Field now, but it was Miller Park. I believe that it was going to be an economic asset to certainly this area, the region, and ultimately the state. And I also believe that the Brewers would have left town if it weren't for us building this. And I think that you can look back 20 plus years later, and I think we can all say, well, yeah, that's turned out to be correct. Is this community, is the region, is the state better off that we have this wonderful facility? And I think the answer is yes, it is. I think it was an investment that was worth it. It's why I think moving forward, we got to figure out a way to continue to do the upgrades that we're required to do on that building. So, you know, how we do that, people figure that out. But yes, I think Miller Park was a good investment. Do I think Fiserv Forum was a good investment? Yes, I do. So, all right, can you use that same logic and say if we build this indoor stadium, this soccer stadium for 8,000 people up in this area, that will rejuvenate that area and you'll have all sorts of people coming down to it? And I guess my response would be two things. First of all, I think minor league soccer is different than NBA basketball and Major League Baseball. I think that is a fact. Secondly, times change and needs change. And I think it is very, very difficult given all the demands we have right now for structural stuff, all the demands for money. I mean, you just look at Milwaukee County and you wonder, okay, there's now this new report that says that we've got to replace the safety building, something I don't disagree with, by the way, and we're looking at money to support the parks and we need money for roads and we need money for this and we need money for that, not to mention the huge pension crisis that's there. It's tough to say, okay, we're going to take $9 million and we're going to take a flyer on contributing to build a soccer stadium. And the argument that is kind of compelling is that if this is such a good investment, if this is going to make money, if this is going to attract all these people, well, okay, maybe that's where the private sector comes in. Maybe that's where, you know, the group of, you know, wealthy people from around the area say, you know what? We think outdoor soccer is a great investment. And we think if we build this, it's going to be absolutely tremendous. And so we're going to put our money up for that. I mean, maybe that's the case. It is tough for me, given all the demands that are out there, to understand why you could justify taking $9 million or more and putting it into a soccer stadium in an area where it's going to be a flyer. There's no question about it. And we've already seen aspects of that whole development that are being scaled back, in part because they're having trouble getting the public financing component. So I guess I'm not surprised by this. I think for the operators, if they want this to happen, what they need to do is they need to perhaps go back to the drawing board and figure out, okay, where are we going to get the private funding for this stadium? How are we going to sell this to investors? If we're able to sell investors, maybe we're going to make it happen. But to expect, I don't know, taxpayers, especially taxpayers outside of this region, to say to somebody in Algoma or Bayfield or La Crosse or Janesville, hey, we want to take $9 million of money and we want to ship it to build this soccer stadium. That's a really tough sell to Republicans and to Democrats in the state legislature. So I'm not surprised this has happened. Would it be nice to have that kind of development? Yeah. But if it makes economic sense, I think it's for the private sector to do. So very glad to have you with us. Well, another milestone, another aspect of my misbegotten boyhood just kind of disappears here. News over the weekend that Indian Mound Camp, Indian Mound, it was a Boy Scout reservation. And this is, I mean, I can remember 2 or 3 years. This is where if you were in Boy Scouts, and I was in Boy Scouts back in the day, it was like the summer camp that you would go to. And they had weekly programs and you would go out there and they had hiking and fishing and merit badges and swimming and all those sort of things. And you'd stay in tents and all that stuff. And I can remember, you know, multiple summers at Indian Mound as the campground. The Boy Scouts closed that last year. It's about a 300-acre wooded property in Summit. And it was, I mean, just a lot of really good memories coming from that. The Boy Scouts, I think, came to the conclusion that they didn't need it. They have another camp that they can use. And candidly, there is all this litigation involving, you know, millions of dollars that had to be paid to the Boy Scout of America Settlement Trust for survivors of abuse in scouting. And so I think the decision was made that, well, you know, we've got to generate some revenue. So one of the things that we're going to do is we're going to look at what we can sell. And they ended up in a situation where Indian Mound was going to be sold. Well, the report is that according to state records posted on Friday, Indian Mound Boy Scout Camp has in fact been sold. Who bought it? Well, the Forest County Potawatomi community spent $6.5 million to buy this almost 300-acre wooded property in Sussex, so in Summit. So the question, not Sussex, Summit. So the question now is, what does Potawatomi intend to do with it? So it's, you know, is this going to be the location for, you know, part of a plan? Are we going to see, you know, efforts to try to put another casino in that particular area to augment the casino they have down here? Is there a need for another casino? Where would Governor Evers be on that? Where would be the Bureau of Indian Affairs? But I can tell you this, Potawatomi didn't spend $6.5 million to buy this closed Boy Scout camp unless they had some plans moving forward. And if I were a betting guy, and I am, I'd say the odds are probably favorable that part of the plan is, you know, maybe figuring out a way we can get, you know, another casino facility in that particular area. Otherwise, it wouldn't make any sense to me as to why they're buying that particular location. But for all those of you who, like me, who spent some of your summers at Indian Mound Boy Scout Camp, that's been closed. And it's now owned by the Forest County Potawatomi, or will be, once the thing closes. When we come back, all right, What's $55 million among friends? Stick around.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the show. Frequently, or at least occasionally, I am asked, okay, what advice would you give to younger people? You know, and I have a couple things. I mean, my first piece of advice, which I stand by, is one of the keys to success is never make the same mistake twice. It's one thing to make a mistake. Oh, I was wrong. But it's and you can come back from that. But every once in a while, you run into people who keep doing the same thing over and over again. It's like you have to learn from the fact that, oh, I thought that this was going to be a good idea. It turned out not to be a good idea. Oh, okay. I have a chance 3 years later to repeat it. No. Never make the same mistake twice. One of the other pieces of advice, go back to, well, when I was at Nicolet High School in the 1970s, I took Latin. And I had our Latin teacher was the late great Juanita Bonneman, and there were a couple. Look, I can still read a little bit of Latin, but there were a couple phrases that stuck in mind. In vito verum, which means in wine there is in vino verum, which means in wine there is truth. All right, I thought that was always a good one. Another one that stuck in my mind that's kind of leads to some of the advice I always give is ars longa vita brevia, which means the road is long, life is short. And I have always interpreted that to mean don't burn bridges if you don't have to. So often I see people who decide that they're going to move on, and maybe they're going to leave a job or something like that, and they just decide that, well, I didn't like who I was working for at the time or whatever, and I'm just going to torch them because it feels good at the moment to just get this all off my chest. I feel I was being unfairly, and I'm going to run them down and I'm going to all do this. I mean, how many people do you know that just do that? They're incapable of just leaving gracefully. And I've always thought, and my advice has always been, you know, it almost never pays to burn bridges unless you absolutely have to. And most of the times, you don't. You know, you just don't. And the people I always respect are the people who say, okay, I'm going to move on, but I don't need to trash where I was or whatever. Great example of that playing out over the last couple of days. The Milwaukee Bucks announced that one of their head coaches, their assistant coaches that's going to be coming in under Adrian Griffin, one of their assistant coaches is going to be a guy named Terry Stotts. If that sounds familiar, it's because Terry Stotts started out in the like early 90s as a coach, an assistant coach. He came with George Karl to the Milwaukee Bucks in 1998. He was an assistant head coach for the Milwaukee Bucks in 1998. He was an assistant head coach until 2002. He went to the Atlanta Hawks and then, you know, ended up actually becoming an interim head coach there. He went, was an assistant coach with Golden State. But in 2005, the Bucks brought him back. And he was the head coach of the Milwaukee Bucks for 2 years, 2005 essentially to 2007. Did okay the first year. They struggled the second year, and the Bucks ended up firing him. So, you know, he left in 2007, and then he's kind of bounced around. He was an assistant coach with the Dallas Mavericks, and then he went on, and he was the head coach for the Portland Trailblazers for, you know, a number of years. So, you know, he was with them for 7 or 8 years as a head coach. Well, ultimately, head coaches wear out their welcome, so he's on the street. He's now coming back to Milwaukee as an assistant coach. So, I mean, this is one of these classic examples of, you know, don't burn your bridges because you never, you know, life is strange. You never know when it might, you know, opportunities might present themselves. Now, my guess is when back in 2007, when the Bucks fired Terry Stotts, My guess is the last thing that he thought of was the chance that, gee, I might have an opportunity to come back here someday as an assistant coach. I mean, I'm sure that's not what he thought. I'm sure that he had all sorts of thoughts about being fired after 2 years, saying, hey, I took him to the playoffs 1 year, and look at the players I've got, et cetera. Nobody could have done better. But he didn't burn those bridges. And he went on to get other assistant head coaching jobs. He went on to get a head coaching job. And now he's back in Milwaukee. It is just a classic example. And it's a great piece of advice to people to keep in mind that, you know, you don't – burning bridges might make you feel good momentarily. But long term, you never know when you're going to run into some of those same people. And even if you think those people might have treated you fairly, unfairly, or you think an organization might have treated you unfairly, you know, you don't trash the organization, because some of the people, a part of that, they might be long gone. You know, who knows where you're going to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now. But if you burn bridges, it's always kind of tough to go back. Not impossible, but very, very difficult. So, I mean, again, you know, ours longer. Remember it. You know, the road is long, and keep that in mind, along with the whole notion that, again, as we were talking about it, never make the same mistake twice. And just always remember, burning bridges rarely helps. Classic example of that playing out with the Milwaukee Bucks basketball team. When we come back, what's $55 million between friends? Stick around. All right. With much fanfare, this morning, there was the long-awaited ribbon cutting, the new East-West Bus Rapid Transit Line, BRT. Whenever you hear those phrases, it's Bus Rapid Transit Line. That is now up and running. It actually started this weekend. Rides are going to be free for the first 4 months. This is the transit line which has taken up, what they've done is they've taken two lanes of traffic along Wisconsin Avenue, running essentially out from Blue Mound Avenue and Wisconsin Avenue, running from essentially the lakefront out to the medical college. So they've taken two lanes of traffic away, and you will have a bus that will run. The bus does not make as many stops as a traditional bus made. Also, because there's fewer stops and you've got the dedicated lane, you don't have the buses having to try to weave in and out of traffic. And the estimates are that if you would ride this bus line all the way from the lakefront out to the medical college campus or back, you could knock about 7 or 8 minutes off the trip. You could take it from like 37 minutes to 29 minutes, something like that. The argument is also that, and of course, if you pick up the bus line somewhere in the middle, you're not going to get that as much of a savings. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, 7 or 8 minutes, which is still a lot longer than if you were driving. But nevertheless, you've got a bit of a savings of time. This service, to put into effect, cost $55 million, the vast majority of which was paid for by the federal taxpayers. So I think the county kicked in like $10 million. Could be a little bit off on that. But it's predominantly paid for by the federal taxpayers. So now you have this bus rapid transit line that's going to save you 7, 8, 9 minutes if you ride it the entire way. They estimate that this is going to average by 2035, which is more than a decade from now. The line is expected to average more than 9,500 weekday riders. How you come up with a projection like that, to me, that's like, you know, throwing darts in the bar, you know, trying to figure out, okay, what it's going to be. Because we've seen projections before, like the ridership on the hop, that turned out to be just completely and totally divorced from reality. But the line is expected to average more than 9,500 weekday riders by 2035. They estimate that it will increase overall transit ridership in this corridor by about 17%. So that's the argument. You know, we can get 17% more riders riding because you can save a couple minutes without having to make these different stops. Now, the flip side of this is, of course, it's $55 million. And you've also now created, you know, huge, well, I guess time will tell. But as far as traffic, trying to drive that route, which is a major alternative route if you're trying to get, again, from the east side to the west side or vice versa, you've now made it a lot more difficult for cars to do that simply because you've got fewer lanes and there's all sorts of rules with regard to parking and right turns and things like that. But with much fanfare, the bus line, it's running. It is a done deal. $55 million. The projections are that the ridership is going to increase to these numbers. Not that, you know, we know who's going to be around, and not that any of the politicians who necessarily signed off on this or who were at the ribbon cutting today are necessarily going to be in office 12 years from now to have to explain or justify their decisions. But it is operating. Nobody wants to wish it ill. For the first 4 months, because it's free, I think you have to take the ridership numbers with a grain of salt. Because, again, it's one thing when it's free, it's new. Here, let's go down and take a ride. We had that with the hop. Since the hop was free when it first started, you'd have people from, like, nursing homes who were taking, honest to God, field trips to go ride the hop because it was free and let's see what this is like. Well, how many of those people, you know, came back? Even though it continues to be free, is another question. But here's what I want to discuss with you. 855-616-1620. Is this going to be a godsend to mass transit in this area? Or is this going to be a white elephant that 6 or 7 or 8 years from now, we look back at it and say, what were we thinking? $55 million to knock off 6, 7, 8 minutes at the expense of various lanes of traffic. 855-616-1620. How is this going to play out moving forward? We discuss. Today is the day. The official ribbon cutting. The East-West Bus Rapid Transit Line is now in operation. It is free for the first 4 months. So if you want to just take a bus ride for the sake of, hey, it's been a long time since I've been on the bus, hop on. You know, it's great, and it will be free. It is a cost, though. Of course, nothing ultimately is free. It was $55 million of taxpayer money to build this line. And it is always, it's kind of amazing that you could spend that much money because you're running on essentially the same streets. But what you've done is you've taken two lanes of traffic and you devoted to buses. $55 million, 855-616-1620. Jeff, this is going to be a flop like the hop. Tom Barrett must be behind this. Well, I don't know about, you know, that. Jeff, this is a white elephant. The BRT replaces by two-thirds the gold line that ran from UWM to Brookfield Square. The bus rapid transit only has one stop within the medical complex. The gold line had five. Well, that's right. So you got to understand, how do they achieve the time savings? Part of it is the dedicated transit lane that comes at the expense of cars, and the other part is like fewer stops. And I guess the thing that has never made any sense to me, never made any sense to me at all, is this idea that you're going to dramatically increase ridership because you knock at best a couple minutes off. If this was a deal where we were saying, okay, it takes you an hour and a half to get somewhere, and because of this, it now takes you an hour. I mean, I understand you've reduced it substantially. In this case, you're talking about a matter of minutes, what, 7 or 8 minutes at the best. At the best. And if you pick it up again on 27th in Wisconsin, well, you're not even going to get that 7 or 8 minutes. You're going to get less time from there. It just seems to me that it's tough to sell that, to really realistically believe that because you can knock off a couple minutes, that is somehow suddenly going to cause all sorts of people who otherwise would not have taken the bus to now say, hey, we're going to take the bus. It makes no sense intuitively to me that is the case. Now, the one thing that it does is it makes driving more difficult. And there's no question in my mind that some of the people that make these decisions aren't just like pro public transportation. They're also anti-car. And so the idea, I guess, becoming if you make it so difficult to drive a car and you dramatically increase the time that it's going to take to drive to get to downtown from the west side, or alternatively to get to the, from the east side out to the Medical College, Wisconsin, if you make it just more difficult to get there because there's fewer lanes of transit, you know, maybe you create the bus as an alternative. But as a practical matter, I just don't see how this happens. Ray in Wauwatosa. Ray, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Ray.
Good afternoon.
Is this going to be a white elephant or a huge success?
Oh, it's a complete waste of money. It's a huge white elephant. It's a completely stupid idea.
What do you
know? There is this new system. It's further between stops. So for senior citizens, you have to walk another block to just get to a station to get on the darn thing.
Right.
Whereas you could have walked right down to the corner, gone over half a block either way, and you were on the Gold Line.
Yes. Yes, exactly. No, thanks for the call. There's all these things. I mean, I argued all along that if you wanted to increase the speed, one of the things that you could have done is you could have, you know, rearranged the stoplights so that, you know, the bus drivers had the ability to extend green lights and things like that. You could have, in that particular situation, would you have necessarily knocked off a full 7 minutes? No, but my guess is you could have probably knocked off three or four, and you could have done it at a fraction of the cost. Look, I'm not anti-public transit. I'm really not. I'm anti-public transit that doesn't make any sense. I'm anti-public transit where you have projections of ridership that are absolutely ridiculous. So here's my only cautionary tale. If over the next couple weeks you're seeing all these glowing reports about, hey, there's this huge ridership and we've had this huge spike of people that are riding, etc., just remember, it's free. Right now, it's free. The numbers of riders that they projected on the hop were based on the fact that people would have to pay a dollar. Well, people don't have to pay. The city is subsidizing that because they know that if it wasn't free, if they charged even 50 cents, they know that the ridership, which is already strikingly low, would just plummet to next to nothing or close to next to nothing. So that's why they don't charge. So we're not going to know, I think, for at least the first 4 months as to whether or not there's even any sort of significant increase at all in this bus rapid transit line. But nevertheless, we have it. Enjoy the $55 million. Time will tell whether it's well spent. You know, we're talking a lot about spending our taxpayer dollars today. There's a story over the weekend. There was there's a very popular Nepalese restaurant in Thienesville. It's called the Chiel, and it was in an historic old building, and it burned to the ground in November of 2020, and it was very, very popular. And I'd been there on a couple occasions. And I understand why it was popular. Anyhow, it burned down. At the time, you know, the owner said, okay, we're going to rebuild and all these different things. And you assume that there was some insurance money and stuff like that that was there. Well, it hasn't been completely rebuilt. But now apparently the announcement that came out just recently is the state taxpayers are giving a $250,000 community development investment grant. That's going to go to the owners of the Chiel to help rebuild their restaurant. I'm torn about these things because on the one hand, yeah, that's great. We're taking, you know, this money and, you know, you want to, you know, have community development and you want to, you know, reinvigorate main streets and things like that. At the same time, I wonder if I was a restaurant owner, for example, in Thienesville, and there's lots of restaurants. If I was a restaurant owner in Mequon, if I was a restaurant owner in Ozaukee County, you know, how would I feel about the fact that, you know, well, there's plenty of restaurants out there, some of whom, you know, I'm sure are struggling and things like that. How would I feel about, you know, one of my competitors getting $250,000 from the taxpayers to help, I mean, rebuild? On the one hand, you know, it's in the interest of the community to have another good restaurant and to have it rebuilt. The flip side of that, though, is, I mean, is it fair? And that's one of the issues that I always wrestle with which is the, you know, picking winners and losers. From my perspective, as somebody who patronized the restaurant, I'm glad that they're going to be able to rebuild. At the same time, if I ran the restaurant across the street or I ran the three or four restaurants that are down the road, I'd be sitting there thinking, okay, well, why are they getting $250,000 to rebuild and build a brand spanking new restaurant that's going to be competing with me? And, you know, I've been in operation. Now, the Chiel was built, it was started in 2014, but you got some of these restaurateurs that have probably been, you know, in operation for 30 or 40 years and could certainly use a whole bunch of money to, I don't know, upgrade their facilities. It's one of the things that I've always wrestled with, which is how do you pick the winners and the losers when it comes to community development, especially when you're dealing with things like restaurants where there's lots and lots of restaurants that are out there. Speaking of winners and losers, there is this movement across the country which operates under the premise that utility rates are unfair, and that people who have more money should be paying more for their utility services than people who have less money, even though they're all using the same amount of electricity, the same amount of natural gas. The argument is it's just not fair to make poor people or poorer people pay the same amount of money as middle class or wealthier people. So there's a couple ways that they're trying to deal with this. In California, and we might have talked about this a few months ago, in California, what they're doing is they're looking at tying electricity bills into the amount of money you make. So, and the way they're looking at doing that is by saying, okay, your household, we are going to impose a fixed fee for utility services on top of what you use. So let's just say we're talking about electricity. You know, you pay for the number of kilowatt hours you use, but you also pay a fixed fee. And that fixed fee is going to be based on the amount of money that you make. So if your household income is under $70,000, you pay $30. If your household income is over $180,000, you pay $92. So you pay three times as much in a fixed fee. And then everybody pays the same for the kilowatt hours. But the idea is that the people who make more money should be out subsidizing the people who make less money. Now, in Wisconsin, there's this move afoot to do something similar, but they want to do it in a different way. Now, lots of people are unhappy with the fact that, you know, the rates are going up. We Energies, you know, imposed an almost 11% increase for residential electric customers. WPS, they had one of 9.4%. And, of course, the irony of this is that one of the reasons why you're seeing an increase in utility rates, and there's a couple factors, but one is this push towards renewable, to the clean energy, and what it's doing is that doesn't come cheaply. So these utilities are under pressure to become more quote-unquote clean and more renewable, so it's costing more, so they've got to raise increased rates. So anyhow, there's a movement afoot which would limit utility bills at 6% of household income. So the push would be that you could not be expected to pay more than 6% of your household income for gas and electric. Now, of course, that's going to make a big difference because, you know, 6% of, I don't know, $2,000 is a much smaller amount than 6% of $10,000 or 6% of $15,000. But the idea would be, you know, we're going to cap it. under no circumstances can you be expected to pay more than 6%. Our number is 855-616-1620, which is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Does this make any sense to you? I mean, should we? Now, we have all sorts of, we've got energy assistance programs and things like that. There's all sorts of stuff out there that helps people, especially lower income people, helps them with their different utility bills and things like that. But this would be just a flat out income redistribution. You know, 6% would be the magic number, and people who, again, pay more, make more money, should be expected to pay more, even though everybody is using essentially the same service. Major income redistribution, is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? We discuss in a moment. See, there is an effort in this state to dramatically overturn what I believe is state law and overturn the way that we pay for utilities. One of my texters points out that Wisconsin law prohibits unjust discrimination in rates. In other words, you know, you pay the same per kilowatt hour for electricity as your neighbor does. Utility customers, you know, generally it's residential, commercial, and industrial. Customers in these categories follow a similar usage pattern, and the cost to serve them is similar. Just like a box of cereal costs the same for somebody making $350,000 a year as it does for somebody making $40,000 a year, the amount you are charged for electricity is the same. And I would argue that that is common sense and it is completely appropriate. And this idea that simply because you make less money, you should be capped at how much that you have to pay for utilities is silly. I mean, it's not like one of our texters makes the point that, hey, if I go through the McDonald's drive-thru and, you know, I have a certain income level, it's not like they're going to charge me, you know, more for my Big Mac than they charge somebody who makes less money or vice versa. Let's talk to Chris in Cedarburg. Chris, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jeff. I agree with you completely. It's
Still there, Chris?
Okay. Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead. We got you. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, in the wintertime, we tape off the windows so there's not a draft to try and save money and all this stuff. And then, you know, I've got friends who have assistants, and the temperature's like 90 degrees, and then the windows are open.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I mean, it's just like, you know,
right.
It's just crazy. I mean, it's just, you know, I think it should be fair and equal. What the cost is the cost. And I know there are some people may need some assistance, but to make people pay more, it's ridiculous.
Well, it is. Chris, this is it. And here's the idea. There are both the federal and the state government, they have numerous programs to assist low-income people with their utility costs, whether it's budget billing and flexible payment programs and more. There are millions of dollars every year that are available to this. So, I mean, my question would be, okay, if we're going to do this, all right, are we now going to eliminate all those different types of programs? Is that – and I don't think anybody's going to necessarily be talking about this. Moreover, the fact that this is so completely and totally arbitrary, getting to your point, Chris, so I'm using the exact same thing. We're using the exact same number of kilowatt hours or whatever for electricity, but simply because – I'm at a certain income level, then I'm going to have to pay more for it. And what about the people that are just, again, slightly over that threshold, whatever the threshold is? Let's say, you know, $28,000 is one of your cutoff points and $70,000 is another. It's another one of these things that creates a disincentive to make money. On top of all that, I mean, allow me to be a cynic. On top of all that, how are you going to reliably verify this? I mean, as a practical matter, what about people whose income changes? What about somebody who, I don't know, one year makes $85,000, putting them in a certain category, and then the next year they make $120,000, and then the year after that they go down and they're making $75,000? How do you break this all down? It seems to me it's a complete and total just just a nightmare as far as trying to, you know, work this all out. Jeff, kind of being behind the curtains, yet in front of our eyes, they're slowly redistributing wealth. When I get a mortgage on my new home, I'm going to pay $3,200 more in closing costs to finance or help finance for people who don't have credit or money down. Right, that's what's going on now under the Biden administration. This is all about, again, wealth redistribution. Now, if you want to talk about, okay, because utility costs are increasing, we need to figure out ways to provide more economic assistance to people, that's okay. But why is it that we would arbitrarily cap it at 6%? Plus, to the point that our last caller, Chris, was making, when it does come to conservation, what incentive is there? What incentive do I have, for example, to not turn my heat up to 82 in the winter and leave the windows open if I know that I'm not going to ever have to pay more than 6% of my income, regardless of how much I use? At least in the California system, and God forbid, I never thought I'd be saying this, at least in what they're proposing in California, there you pay for the electricity you use. You just pay a different fixed cost based on income. Now, I don't like that either, but at least that creates a disincentive for people to just crank up the air conditioning during the summer or crank up the heat during the winter. This proposal, capping it at simple a percentage of your income, gives you no incentive at all to conserve. And circling back to where we were in the first place, I do think it's both interesting and ironic to ask, what is one of the major reasons driving the increase in utility costs? Well, it's because the government is putting all these pressure on utilities to, again, go to clean energy, whatever that is, figure out the renewables, invest more in solar, invest more in wind, which is very, very expensive and, frankly, doesn't give you anywhere near the return for your buck that you would if you were, I don't know, using coal. And I'm not advocating using coal. I'm just saying the government creates this problem by contributing, at least, to the increase in costs and then turns around and say, okay, we've created this problem. Now we're going to expect those who are better off financially than others to end up paying for it. Your government at work. Jeff, this is a truly terrible idea. If it passes, I would want limits on what a person could do to have their thermostat set at. I don't want to pay for somebody setting their air conditioner low and their heater high. Well, good luck with that. Jeff, I own rental properties, and my tenants on energy assistance always have their houses really warm in the winter and really cold in the summer. My self-pay tenants always are constant temp year-round. Now, I mean, it's tough to generalize, and I'm sure that that's not true of everybody, but it's just the reality. You treat a rental car differently than you treat a car that you own. You treat a rental property differently than you treat the home that you own. That's just kind of the reality. Do you have skin in the game? And if from the perspective of utilities, if you know that, gee, I can't pay more than 6%, that's what it's going to be, can't pay more than 6% of my income per month, so what do I care if I run up the heating bills? What do I care if I run up the air conditioning bills? No skin off my nose, because it's essentially free to me once I hit that 6%. You don't think people are going to take advantage of that? Well, if that's really your belief, be sure to tuck your shoulder when you fall off the turnip truck so you don't hurt yourself. A lot of great stuff coming up in the next hour of the program, including, all right, would you pay $339 to watch something? I'll explain. We'll discuss.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Why far more poorly? I'm getting more cynical in my old age. And I try to fight that. But there was a story over the weekend. You know who Chuck Todd is, right?
Of
Meet the Press. So Chuck Todd has announced that he's going to be stepping down as the moderator of Meet the Press in September. And, you know, he says, well, he's 50. Now, he's not 60, he's not 70, he's 50. He says that, you know, he's conscious of the fact that many leaders overstay their welcome, and he'd rather leave a little bit too soon than stay too long. Okay, you get that. He says, I've let work consume me for nearly 30 years. I can't remember the last time I didn't wake up before 5 or 6 a.m. I've watched too many friends and family let work consume them before it was too late. I promised my family I wouldn't do that. So that's what he says. All right. So, but of course, I do mention he's 50. He's not 60. He's not 65. He's 70. He's 50. So that's one thing. Hey, I just want to kind of dial back and all, right? That's one thing. The cynic in me, though, looks at something else. You know where Meet the Press falls in ratings among CBS and ABC and NBC? Would you like to guess?
I would have to guess number three.
It guess number three, absolutely. Meet the Press, which was kind of like the – it was sort of the gold standard when Tim Russert – was the moderator of that. And Tim Russert passed away in 2008. And then David Gregory took over till 2014. And then Chuck Todd's done it since 2014. And the ratings have been slipping and slipping and slipping. And yes, Meet the Press right now is in a constant third behind CBS's Face the Nation and ABC's This Week, you know, the George Stephanopoulos thing.
It might be a situation where it benefits both of them. They get the refresh, maybe a ratings boost, and Chuck Todd, if he's serious, gets to spend time with his family, which would be great for him.
Yes. See, and that's the refreshing thing, because you are not as cynical as I am. My point is that if this was number one in the ratings instead of number three, my guess is Chuck Todd would have wanted to stay a little bit longer, and NBC would have done everything they could to keep him to stay a little bit longer. But when you're number three in the ratings out of three, it's easier to kind of say, okay, time for us to go refresh yourself. Go hang out with your family at the age of 50. Not that there is anything wrong with that.
No, it's a cleaner exit than some of the other high-profile exits recently.
Well, that's true, right? It's very good point. It's not Tucker Carlson. You're exactly right. It's not that and lawsuits. And my guess is this is something that was worked out mutually beneficially. And he's going to stay at NBC. And my guess is there'll probably be some quiet payments and things like that. But it's one of these interests where I'm sure NBC was ready for him to move on. And I appreciate the fact that he's willing to move on gracefully. You got to love that.
Yeah, it seems like it's going to hopefully it works out for both of them and everybody gets what they want.
But unless you're a fan of CBS's Face the Nation or This Week, in which case you want to see Meet the Press continue to tank. Yeah, you know, so it's always those different considerations. Okay, tomorrow is the day. If you are – I have never subscribed to NFL Sunday Ticket. NFL Sunday Ticket has up until this year, I think, only been exclusively available in DirecTV, and I haven't had DirecTV. And even if I had DirecTV, I wouldn't have spent the money for it. Sunday Ticket is the NFL product that allows you to watch out-of-market games. So in other words, if you live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and you are a fan of the Buffalo Bills, and you know the Buffalo Bills game isn't a national game and it's not being carried on local television because there are only so many games that you can carry at any given time – Direct Ticket allows you to watch the Buffalo Bills play the New England Patriots or whatever. You can watch all those games or almost all of them if they're not on national TV. So it really – if you are a Green Bay Packers fan, for example, and you winter – well, you spend your fall in Florida. You're down in Florida from, you know, early October on and you want to watch the Packers games. Well, okay, Direct Ticket gives you the ability to do that. And you can have people come over. It is not an inexpensive experience. Here is the deal. Google, which owns YouTube Live TV, and I don't know how many people are familiar with YouTube Live TV, but it's kind of like Hulu TV. It is a streaming service that serves as a competitor largely to your traditional cable sort of things. If you subscribe to Hulu TV, you get I don't know. I mean, to YouTube TV, there's like a basic 40 channels or so. It's got your local over-the-air TV things, and then it's got many of the typical cable stuff. It's got ESPN on it. It's got TNT. You know, a lot of the stuff that you would find in your basic sort of cable thing you get on Hulu TV. But it's a streaming service, and I happen to have it because of the situation we have in Florida. So, but if you have it there, you have it here. I have not cut the cable, so I still have Spectrum here, but I have access to YouTube TV. What happened is Google, which owns YouTube TV, is paying the NFL $2 billion annually for NFL Sunday ticket. So here's the way this is going to work. The basic charge of YouTube TV is like $73 a month. Okay, if you are a subscriber to YouTube TV and you do this before tomorrow, June 6th, you can get NFL Sunday ticket for $249. After tomorrow, after June 6th, it goes up to $349. $349. And then if you are not a YouTube TV subscriber, you can still get it, but that goes up to $449 after tomorrow. So tomorrow is kind of like this drop-dead date if you want to get a substantial savings on this. So there's a lot of people out there who I'm sure looked at this and said, you know, is this worth it to me, et cetera, and then ended up, you know, now it's really kind of crunch time, because if you're thinking about making this purchase, gee, I'd like to have this Sunday ticket. And you wait till after tomorrow, you're going to cost yourself a third more. I mean, you know, you're going to cost yourself an extra $100. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. I never tell people how to spend their money. And I remember when, like I said, I've never had this Sunday ticket. I'm a fan of football. Don't get me wrong. I like it. But I'm primarily a Packers fan. And the fact that I have access to other than all the national games and the games that are going to be on local TV, I've never felt a desire to have to go out and buy this Sunday ticket, especially since I live in an area where I can get the Packers games over the air. And it's really been tough for me to justify saying, okay, if I act before tomorrow, it's going to cost me $250. If I act after tomorrow, it's going to be $350 or $450 or whatever this is. It's tough for me to justify that expense. Now, Google charges this, YouTube TV charges this, because they're paying the NFL $2 billion a year. All right. Will there be people that buy this? Will there be enough people that spend this kind of money to watch the out-of-market games so that Google doesn't lose its shirt? How much interest does there continue to exist in out-of-market games for the NFL? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. I remember when YouTube TV first announced this new pricing package that they had with NFL Sunday Ticket, I remember thinking, huh, that's interesting. I've got YouTube TV. So this, unlike before, I could never get Sunday Ticket because I didn't have DirecTV. But okay, I've got YouTube TV, so I'm already a subscriber. I'm going to continue that. So all right, it's easier to do this. All I have to do is go to the YouTube TV account, click a couple buttons, and mysteriously, you know, my credit card's going to get charged, whatever it was. And I remember when this was first announced, and they said, well, $249 for subscribers. And I thought, oh, that's a crazy amount of money. But I don't know, maybe would I use that? If my wife is listening, she wants to find out how this is coming down. And then I thought, well, okay, I'm gonna put this discussion aside because I don't have to decide right now. Well, now, if you're a YouTube TV subscriber, you do have to decide, because after tomorrow, June 6th, if you want this same package, you want this NFL, you know, Sunday ticket package, you have to, it's going to cost you $100 more. So if you're like me and you've been at least considering it, now it's at the point where, well, I mean, I'm not going to just throw away $100. But I will tell you, I'm just as conflicted as I was whenever they announced this a couple months ago, as I sit here today, I'm still just as conflicted, because I wrestle with this idea of would I really use it? Look, I'm a huge Packers fan, like I said, and if I was not living in southeastern Wisconsin, if I wasn't here for the fall Well, I guess I would seriously consider that because on Sundays I want to be able to watch the Packers game and I don't want to be shut out if they're not, you know, being shown on the national market. So if I was living out a market, yes, I would do it. But for somebody like me who is a Packers fan, I like football and I like the different football games, but where my rooting interest is Green Bay, you know, would I shell out an extra $250 or $350 or $450 just for the ability to watch other NFL games? It's just, it seems to me it doesn't make any sense, or at least maybe I'm just not that big a fan. The big games that you're going to want to watch are probably going to be on national TV. Now, again, if I'm a Cleveland Browns fan, and I have some of my teammates here who I know are, if you're a Cleveland Browns fan and you want to watch Cleveland Browns football and you're living in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, well, maybe it's worth that extra, you know, $20 a week to do that. But for me, no. Jeff, I'm a diehard Cowboys fan, and you know, they're on plenty. There's no way in a heck, though, I would spend that kind of money to watch non-nationally televised games. There's plenty of updates. And for me, you know, that's enough. Another texter, Jeff, there's no way I would do this. I won't even pay $20 a month to watch the Brewers. Yeah, that's one of the points that a couple of our texters are making. They say, look, Bally Sports is $20 a month or $240 a year just for your local Major League Baseball or NBA team. So the NFL Sunday ticket is at least all the games. The difference, though, is that for the Bally Sports app, for example, you're watching your favorite team. You know, you're a Brewers fan. You're a Bucks fan. You want to be able to watch those games, you know, regardless of where you are, whether you're here in Milwaukee or whether you're, you know, somewhere across the country. You want to be able to watch that. That's a distinction, and it's a difference between this, which is watching games that you don't necessarily support. In any event, like I said when I started this conversation, I never tell people how to spend their money, and I'm sure that for diehard sports fans, there's going to be an interest. For me, my instinct is, gee, given how I watch television and given the fact that, you know, do I really care, you know, when the Los Angeles Chargers play the Las Vegas Raiders, do I really care about watching that game at 3 o'clock or 3:30 on a Sunday as opposed to some other game? And the answer is, no, I really don't care that much about it. And I certainly don't care $250 or $300 a month or $450 a month. If you do, go with God, that's great. But you should know that this is, again, if you don't act by tomorrow, you're going to be paying $100 on top of what you could do by paying today. So keep it in mind, make your decision, and then act accordingly. Me, I think I'm going to save that $250. I think there's other things that I'd like to spend it on. Over the weekend, my producer, Charlie, had the ability, even though we were not working together, had the ability to make me feel old. Because here's the story. He was producing Wisconsin's, the Sunday morning news program with my friend Libby Collins, and I happened to have it on. I was listening on Sunday mornings, I play golf with some friends of mine at a public golf course in Saukville, Hawthorne Hills. We've been doing that since the group has changed over the years, but I've been doing that since like the early 80s. I look forward to Sundays a lot. So I am driving out to play golf, and I am listening to WTMJ on my AM radio in my new car. So bought a new car, and it's got AM radio, and I'm listening to the AM radio. And Libby is talking about, I forget even what the reference, the reference is, she said that her husband in Florida plays tennis with Marla Maples. They were talking about pickleball or something like that, but it says plays tennis with Marla Maples. And then there's this pause, and she says, Charlie, do you know who Marla Maples is? And my producer, Charlie, draws a complete and total blank. You know, no, not at all. And it's kind of a generational thing because, I don't know, Charlie, what do you think? What percentage of the people listening to us now do you think know who Marla Maples is? What percentage?
I would say 60%.
60, yeah, maybe. And in fairness, the only reason 60% might know is because Marla Maples is the second wife of Donald Trump. And of course, people know stuff about Trump. If Donald Trump had not been elected president in 2016 and hadn't been in the news constantly since 2015, my guess is there's a lot of people who wouldn't have known who Marla Maples was, just, you know, because they wouldn't have been as focused on Trump. But yes, you're right. Marla Maples is the ex-wife, the second wife. There was Ivana, and then there was Marla Maples, and now there's Melania. Who are there? So it was the second one. But I'm sitting there and I'm listening to this. I'm thinking, man, there's this entire generation or multiple generations out there who maybe it's just a part of pop culture or whatever. But yeah, Marla Maples back in the news. Hey, speaking of the news, if something happens and it doesn't get written about, is it still happening? I ask this question because a couple of the national papers are reporting something that is going on at the newspaper chain that owns the local paper. Gannett, which is the country's largest newspaper chain, apparently, here's the story, hundreds of staffers at Gannett Newspapers are protesting their company's leadership and job cuts. And apparently, well, this is the way the Washington Post reports it, journalists for the largest newspaper chain in the country are going to walk off the job this week in a series of strikes staged in part to protest the leadership of the company's chief executive. Hundreds of staffers for 24 Gannett newspapers, including the Arizona Republic, the Austin American-Statesman, and the Palm Beach Post, say they will not report to work for a day or two starting Monday, forfeiting pay and foregoing assignments ranging from city council meetings to high school sports championship games. At some papers, the strikes begin Tuesday. Their aim is to call attention to budget cuts and to put pressure on shareholders who want to take up the issue of executive pay at a meeting. I don't see anything that says whether or not this kind of walkout is going to affect any of the Wisconsin-based Gannett newspapers. Nothing's been listed there. But it is interesting because you have an industry which is clearly in turmoil, an industry where fewer and fewer people are paying for hard copies of newspapers, an industry where it has been just relentless cost cutting, which means like relentless layoffs, at least across the industry for years and years with no signs of that stopping. And now you have reporters who are, you know, going on strike, or at least a temporary strike, you know, job actions in order to call attention to it. Is it going to make a difference? Probably not. But it is something that's going on. Is it going to happen here in Milwaukee? Haven't seen anything that suggests it, but it is happening at Gannett newspapers all across the country. One of our texters says, Jeff, do you know why that Google is paying $2 billion to the NFL every year for the Sunday ticket games? And makes a pretty good point. He said, here's why they're doing it. Two things. One, sports gambling, and two, fantasy football. I'm not into sports gambling and I don't do fantasy football. And so maybe that's why I don't see the interest in it, but a lot of people do. When we come back, how much extra would you pay to not tip? Stick around. We started off this program talking about that horrible story from Saturday night where the almost 2-year-old girl was shot, 19th and Atkinson, around 8 p.m. Saturday. The 27-year-old, believed to have been involved in that, has now been arrested. He was arrested during like a high-risk traffic stop that they made in Kenosha on yesterday afternoon. The girl was inside a vehicle and was shot during an argument between what they describe as known adults. The guy is in custody. They have not formally issued charges yet, although I would expect that that would be forthcoming, if not today, probably by tomorrow, and we'll know a lot more about it. I think there's lots of speculation that the person involved in the shooting was no stranger necessarily to the criminal justice system, and my guess is that's going to turn out to be true. But it doesn't bring the 2-year-old back to life. What it does, though, is underscore, if in fact he had been through the criminal justice system on other occasions, it does underscore that whatever we're doing isn't deterring people who aren't supposed to be carrying guns from carrying guns? And I think that's one of the questions that we need to deal with. You know, what? Why do we continue to tolerate people who? Why do we continue to tolerate? You know, so much people who aren't allowed to carry guns carrying guns. All right, we have talked a couple times on this program about the fact that I think for a lot of us nowadays, we're hitting kind of a wall. It's tipping fatigue. You know, we've discussed the fact that nowadays, I don't know, you go to the Brewers game, for example, and you go through the self-service kiosks and you grab a bottle of beer or a can of beer out of one of the containers and you go up and you pull out your credit card at the self-service thing and it asks you if you're going to tip. And the question becomes, okay, who am I going to tip? I understand that there's somebody standing there in case there's a problem, but it was a self-service thing. Why in the world would I tip? And yet, wherever you go nowadays, where you pay with the credit card, you get that little thing that says, you know, do you want a tip? I fully expect it. This morning, I stopped off at my local drugstore because I had to pick up a prescription. You know, and I go and I give them my name and stuff. And then there's the thing that comes up and it says, okay, you know, you got to give the last four digits of your telephone number to identify yourself. And then it asks if you want to make a donation to something. I fully expected that I was going to see an entry asking me if I wanted to tip the woman behind the counter who was giving me my prescription medicine. But it didn't. But you know that that's coming. So, I mean, I think there's a question of tipping fatigue. And a lot of people, the other term is kind of like guilt tipping, things that you just never under normal circumstances would have been expected to tip. Now, you know, there's almost this expectation and you're kind of pressured into this by, you know, they give you that thing and you put your credit card in it and it's like, okay, are you going to leave a tip? I mean, yesterday morning, I stopped off at a Quick Trip to put gas in the car. You know, I pull out my credit card, you know, I put it in there. I fully expected that right after it asked me if I wanted to have my car washed, it was going to ask me, do you want to leave a tip? I mean, and the question is, well, why not? Why? If we're tipping, you know, the people at the self-service kiosks, you know, why aren't I tipping the attendant who's behind the door at the Quick Trip? Didn't do it yet, but that's where we are leading, which brings me to this story. There is a new restaurant that is opened in Madison, and they have announced that they are going to have a no tipping policy. What they're saying is that they have made the decision that they are going to pay their staff a sufficient amount of money, so the expectation is that you do not need to tip. And this is the way it works in, I don't want to say all of Europe, but this is the way it works in many, many countries. You are not expected to tip. You go in and the cost of service is built into your bill. And it might be, I don't know, it might be you might round up maybe, you know, if it's a deal where, you know, your coffee is €8 or $7, and let's say it's 7.5 euros, you might round up to €8 or something like that. But you're not expected to tip 10 or 15 or 20, 25%. That's not built in. And one of the ways they can always tell the Americans is people come and they add an extra 20% to the bill, which in most, at least many European countries, isn't how they do it. So anyhow, this restaurant in Madison that has opened up, it's called Sultan. And the owner of the restaurant says, okay, here's the deal. We are a no tipping restaurant. They say that employees are paid higher wages than traditional servers and bartenders, and they don't need tips to sustain their income. The owner says, I don't think the customer should have to subsidize my workforce. I believe people should be paid what they're worth. Okay, which all sounds good. Well, here's the deal. Staff are paid $20 per hour plus profit sharing. Each customer receipt says tipping is not necessary and credit card slips don't have a spot for the gratuity. Okay, so here's that's it. They say the behind the scenes person, the back of the house people, they, you know, the people that are the dishwashers and the cooks and stuff, they love it. The people who are the servers aren't necessarily as thrilled about it because in many cases they can make more than $20 per hour. But that's his policy. And he says, well, I don't think customers should subsidize it. Well, the point though is customers do subsidize it because you are going to have to, in order to pay, your employees $20 an hour, you're going to have to charge significantly more for what you are selling than if you were selling stuff and paying your employees like $4 an hour and then having them go on tips. So the restaurant owner, the restaurant patrons are in fact paying for it. They're just paying for it in a different way. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Would you rather, from your perspective as a customer, would you rather go to a restaurant where tipping is expected but voluntary and have lower prices for food, or would you rather go to a restaurant that essentially tells you no tipping, but that 15% or the 20% or whatever it's going to take to get to $20 an hour is built into the bill? 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. No tipping restaurants, but understanding that your cost is going to be a lot higher because the cost of service is going to be built in, or the ability to go pay less, at least in a base price, and then, you know, leave the tip yourself. 855-616-1620. We discuss. 855-616-1620, which is the Old National Bank talk and text line. There's this restaurant in Madison that just opened up. The owner says, it's a no-tipping restaurant. I pay my employees $20 an hour. I don't expect customers to subsidize it. Well, yes and no, because you are going to be if the place is going to stay in business, you are going to be subsidizing it because his food cost, you know, what he charges customers, is going to have to reflect the fact that that's what he's paying his staff. So I guess that's the question. Would you rather go to a place where you're going to pay more, but you don't have to worry about tipping, or would you rather the traditional thing of tipping? Now, I think this would, to me, would be very controversial with servers. One of our texters says, hey, I'm a bartender. I can make $48 an hour on a slow night with tips. I would not work at this place that no tipping is allowed. If my job changed to that policy, the price of our steaks would be $150 and a medium price wine would be about the same. So you have to pay for it one way or the other. Margie in Maguanago. Margie, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah. My thought on this is you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, I guess, because I have worked in a restaurant in the back of the house and my sister has been in the front of the house as a waitress. And yes, she made more than I did, but at the same time, the back of the house will make the front of the house look good or bad, depending on how well everybody works together.
Right.
And if you're, you know, either way, if you're disgruntled because you don't make a lot of money and you're in the back of the house and you're not making sure the dishes are washed and there's enough silverware and bowls and plates and everything for the front, then the front's going to look bad. If you put out crappy food or it doesn't look good, then the waitress is not going to get tipped as well either. So it's one of those things. And my thought process was, what about at the end of the night, everybody makes the same amount, and then the back of the house makes X, and if the front of the house wants to see if they're doing better, then they get ranked by the customers. The customers put in a ranking, and that's how their bonus, quote-unquote, tips work.
Yeah, thanks for calling. I mean, I got to think that's too much work. You know, I mean, I guess from the perspective of the customers, I mean, I think you have to go one way or the other. Now, it's interesting because I'm getting swamped with texts on this, and the majority of people say the concern is that if you don't have a system of tipping, what will happen is there will be there'll be a decline in service, that then there's no incentive to be a good waiter or a good waitress, a good server. I don't know if that's necessarily the case. See, I think the happy medium on this, and there's a lot of places that I frequent that do this, they say that there's a minimum tip that's built in. They haven't done away with tipping, but it's made clear at the beginning that there is going to be there's a 15% or a 20%, whatever the number might be, gratuity that is built in, and it's going to be added to your bill. But customers have the option to change that. So, you know, if you want to add a dollar more or something, you can do that. If you want to subtract the dollar, if you'd want to not tip at all because of that experience, you can do that. That's kind of the happy medium in this. Jeff, I personally think not only a tip but also tax should be rolled into the price on the menu so I know what the bottom line of all this is. Another texter says, I'd rather pay one price for quality food and service rather than tipping. Employees deserve to be paid a decent wage no matter what the job is. You don't get tipped for the quality of your radio commentary. Yeah, that's the point I made before. People don't come up to me when I'm broadcasting at State Fair and say, Jeff, we've been listening to the program for 25 years. We think you are the greatest thing since canned beer. Here's $10. No, I don't get tipped for that kind of stuff, and that's okay. I don't expect to be tipped for that kind of stuff. What my friends and employers at Good Karma do, they put money in my checking account every twice a month, and I'm very, very glad to have that done. It's I think this is it's something that we are still wrestling with. And what this owner is doing, I think, is responding to the notion that there is kind of tipping fatigue that's out there. I still believe, though, that in your basic the areas where people have traditionally tipped, I think most servers, at least, are better off. I guess it might depend on, in the majority of cases, maybe it varies from restaurant to restaurant, but in the majority of cases, most of the people I know who have worked in the service industry would tell you that they would much rather have a smaller, you know, base wage and be allowed to take their tips because they end up making a lot more money that way. For me, I don't really care that much one way or the other as long as the policy is disclosed. But be aware that if you go to this particular restaurant in Madison and you see sticker shock looking at the menu prices, well, that's because it's just another way of paying the staff. One way or the other, whether it's tipping or not, you know, if you're going to get quality people, you've got to assure that they make a certain level of money.